Dr. Horn, a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yep. And so let's start with this, I don't know, some are calling charade, circus, certainly interesting condition called the U.S. presidential election, with some unprecedented things, including the negatives in terms of public perception about both major party candidates.
Well, you are correct, and the public is also correct in having a negative perception about the Republican Donald J. Trump and the Democrat Hillary Rodham Clinton. The United States faces a real crisis moment right now because, on the one hand, there's this international situation where China is advancing, where Russia has not been brought to heel, and where there's a lot of loose talk in Washington as a result about war, believe it or not, with China and or Russia sooner rather than later. However, one of the complicating factors is that the hawks and the neocons, who historically have attached themselves to the Republican Party, have expressed some discontent with the Republican nominee, Donald J. Trump. And so, therefore, many of them are defecting to the column of Hillary Rodham Clinton. This, in some ways, reminds me of the U.S. presidential election of 1964, when the Democrats under Lyndon Baines Johnson were successful, understandably perhaps, in painting the Republican nominee, Barry Goldwater, the conservative senator from Indiana, as being erratic, as the kind of man you would not want to have his finger on the nuclear button, as a person who was hostile to equality and human rights and civil rights. And that led directly to a landslide for Lyndon Johnson, who then, of course, as we all know, then escalated the war in Vietnam, began raining down bombs on Vietnam, and therefore set the stage for a Republican comeback in 1968 with discredited Richard M. Nixon. In some ways, we know that history does not repeat itself, but it does rhyme, as is often said. And if you look at the polls right now, with Hillary Rodham Clinton surging ahead, there is a possibility that once again, the Democrats will attain a landslide victory in November, but then that'll just set the stage for military conflict in 2017. We already know that Hillary Rodham Clinton was an engineer of the failed invasion and bombing of Libya that overthrew Muammar Gaddafi. We know that she is to the right of the Obama administration on intervention in Syria. And therefore, we should be quite concerned. Now, fortunately, there are alternatives in this election. That is to say that I was very struck in looking at the Huffington Post this morning to note that Jill Stein of the Green Party amongst black voters is ahead of Donald J. Trump. She's also ahead of Gary Johnson, the Libertarian. Mm. That is to say that according to the Huffington Post, Hillary Rodham Clinton is getting 83% amongst black voters. Jill Stein is getting 8%, and Gary Johnson and Trump come after that. Now, this is just after the nomination a few days ago. So I think that if we can build not only on that campaign, but other left-wing campaigns, we will be sending a message to the U.S. ruling elite that they will have difficulty in ignoring. That is to say that there are millions and millions of voters who are not in favor of continual and continuous war. And we should also recognize that the presidential election provides a wonderful opportunity for expressing this message. Al Gore can tell you that you can get the most votes in a presidential election and still lose. A U.S. presidential election, because of the archaic, antiquated electoral college, is actually 51 different elections. That is to say, 50 states and the District of Columbia. And we already know in advance who is going to prevail in 40 of those states. That is to say, we know, and history tells us, that it will be immensely difficult, to put it mildly, for the Democrats to prevail in Mississippi and Louisiana and Alabama and a good deal of Dixie. We also know that it would be insane to keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. That's to say, still continually running up these Democrats against Republicans in Dixie and expecting a different result, even though history over the decades has told us otherwise. So why not run left-wing candidates, anti-war candidates, progressive candidates, pro-reparations candidates in these particular states and pile up tens of thousands, perhaps millions of votes? It seems to me that this is a no-brainer.
Yeah. It's interesting that that hasn't been attempted on any large scale yet. I want to go to the landscape for this election. You have perhaps three manifestations, at least that's how it appears to me, of working class uprising, essentially, behind Sanders up to the point of the convention, and having met a lot of those folks at the convention, many of them plan to continue in that state. The workers, I would say almost exclusively, but primarily white workers behind Trump, and which is a good part of the constituency. We met them in Cleveland as well. And then, of course, the people that have been in the streets, Black Lives Movement and such. And the expression of, for example, that part of the working class that was behind Sanders was, essentially betrayed. Certainly, that's the feeling that the majority of them demonstrated at the convention. The approach to the people in the streets has been sort of multivaried. Attempts to co-opt on the one hand and, insert leadership that would proceed to the Democratic Party. Also, with the shooting of police officers, attempts to demonize the, entire movement. And then, of course, there is the entire elite lining up from the media and everyone else against Trump, who, meanwhile, in terms of those foreign policy items that are important, including the possibility of World War III, he's actually staked out a different, in some ways, oppositional position, to the extent you can take the word of any American politician, and particularly one with a background in real estate sales. So what is it exactly that can be done in that environment, and of course looking past the election, in terms of particularly what seems to me important, building some unity in the working class?
Well, first of all, with regard to Trump and foreign policy, I must take off my hat to The Nation, the weekly published in Manhattan, which has been second to none in its opposition to Trump, but at the same time reprimanded the Democrats and certain Democratic-leaning columnists like Paul Krugman of The New York Times when they have tried to paint Trump as some sort of proxy or agent for Vladimir Putin. It's a total capitulation and surrender to the worst Cold War biases. In fact, we even see that at the Olympics, yeah, where you have these gold medal swimmers from the United States who are engaging in Cold War behavior with their Russian competitors. This is all part of what appears to be an insane march towards a conflict with a leading nuclear power. It really is something that we should all be concerned about. Now, with regard to a class analysis of these elections, I think it's very important to get the history straight. And that's one of the downfalls and one of the weaknesses of the U.S. left, which tends to romanticize and glamorize the uglier aspects of U.S. history. The United States has a very good hustle going, as they say in the streets. When there's something negative attached to U.S. history, and of course a good deal of it's negative, expropriation of Native Americans, enslavement of Africans, that's said to be not in tune with our founding values. That's not who we are, as Obama often says. Right. And anything that's positive, that's who we are. I mean, what a hustle! I mean, and sadly, many of the left go along with this. What we need to tell those white working class supporters of Donald Trump is this, that you have a justifiable beef. But the beef is with the billionaire class, as Bernie Sanders might say. What I mean is that if you look at U.S. history, there was a kind of American dream for some, even though the late comedian George Carlin is correct when he suggested that it's an American dream because you have to be asleep in order to believe it.
Right.
But that's not altogether accurate because there are numerous cases of poor, straggling Europeans crossing the Atlantic, and because of expropriation of land from Native Americans, they can get land and they can get it stocked with Africans, and they can become wealthy. And that wealth is then passed on down the line to their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. But the working class needs to be told that those days are over and that the ruling class, in many ways, is moving and has moved to change the rules of the game for them. That kind of spectacular upward mobility is going to be very difficult going forward, and that the only way out is not continued alliances with billionaires, but alliances with their class brothers and sisters. Because the rules of the game have changed. We need to know that the rules of the game have changed, not least because of international pressure. That's to say that the Haitian revolutionaries and their comrades within the British abolitionist movement helped to create a general crisis for the slave system that led to that system's collapse, which thereby helped to free the enslaved Africans in North America, and that in the 20th century, the rise of a socialist camp and allied national liberation movements in the Caribbean and Africa helped to convince the U.S. ruling elite that if they wanted to compete with the socialist camp, they had to remove the more egregious aspects of white supremacy that were visited in the first place upon people of African descent. And that led to a change in the rules of the game. And that has led to the present situation that we are now facing. Therefore, the way out is not perpetual and constant conflict abroad with Russia and China in the first place, but with concord with those who are in conflict with the U.S. ruling elite, and concord with those who are in our class category here at home. That's a very simple lesson, but apparently it's a very difficult lesson to absorb. And I think it's more important than ever to absorb this lesson, because if you look at that stunning and staggering report that the Department of Justice put out on the Baltimore Police Department, it reeked of the worst excesses of apartheid South Africa. If you did not live in the United States, you might find it difficult to believe that a reign of terror was inflicted upon the black American population. But I think that hopefully a response has been within that black American community to break with the politics of the past, to begin to look towards political alternatives, to begin to protest more clamorously, particularly as expressed in the Black Lives Matter movement, and it would serve well the interests of the Euro-American working class to link up with that kind of movement, because that old pattern of thinking that the way out is alliance with the U.S. ruling elite against, say, Native Americans, as it happened in the 19th century, that path has been blocked, not to mention that it's unethical and immoral, and therefore a new path has to be blazed.
You know, I witnessed some things that were, they're very interesting to observe, and frankly, left me agape here and there, just in terms of the like realignment that's taken place in such a short, at least in apparently such a short period of time. At the Republican convention, for example, and I was very close. I was stage right against the wall, like 9 people from the front of the stage, and could see pretty much the entire arena react, which is what I was paying attention to. And when Trump said that the regime change and nation-building project was over, I saw the assembled Republican Party stand up and applaud wildly. And this is at a Republican convention, not let's go blow this up or that. He did some things with ISIS and this and that, and he got a response. But the biggest response I saw was that. It's like this deeply held feeling that even reaches there. And then at the Democratic convention, when Leon Panetta was speaking, and this happened also with Madeleine Albright to a smaller degree, but when Panetta was speaking and the Sanders delegates, or in any event, the large anti-war constituency of the assembly got up and started chanting "No more war," they were shouted down by people who apparently were instructed by the Clinton campaign to use this as a response, USA, USA, and showing like a break, you know, inside the Democratic Party over that issue and unanimity among the Republicans against war. Bizarre for me.
Well, I think that's what's happening right now with not only the defections of many hawks and neocons to the Clinton column, but many corporate elites as well. There are many dangers involved in this process. One of the dangers is that two of the major constituencies of the Democratic Party, I'm speaking of the AFL-CIO unions, Service Employees International Union, American Federation of Teachers, American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, et cetera, they're really not up to speed on foreign policy. And the same holds true, I'm afraid, for what former NAACP Chairman Margaret Bush Wilson called the big minority. I'm speaking of Black Americans. That, of course, we know has a lot to do with the previous epoch. That is to say, the Cold War epoch, when radical leftists and labor were routed. I'm speaking of Harry Bridges of the International Longshore and Warehousemen's Union in San Francisco, and of course, Paul Robeson in terms of the Black Liberation Movement. And this has meant that in the contemporary epoch, those two major constituencies are really not up to speed and are crippled when it comes to grappling with the more profound aspects of foreign policy. And this inevitably puts wind in the sails of the hawks and the neocons who are able to leverage their advantage there in terms of the national budget, helping to shovel more money to the Pentagon and for war fighting, because our constituencies, such as labor and the national minorities, are not able to articulate a consistent anti-war and peace message. So this is a very dangerous situation that we're faced with. It's difficult to say how this is going to play out. I mean, for example, once again, this excoriating of Donald J. Trump because he has he's basically taking a position on Moscow that represents the pre-2014 Obama position.
Right.
Recall that Obama's position was to have a reset with Russia so that there could be a pivot towards China. But what intervened was the Russian intervention in the Crimea, which has complicated relations with Russia and has led to this present downturn. And so when Trump tries to work out some sort of entente with Putin, he's really only expressing the pre-2014 Obama position. But you would not know that from reading the press. In fact, I think that students of journalism will have a field day in coming years and decades in analyzing the press coverage of this campaign. In some ways, it reminds me of how the U.S. press dealt with Howard Dean, the former Vermont governor who made a challenge for the White House some years ago after his infamous scream.
Yeah, one scream and he's gone. One scream and he was gone.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. I mean, it was such a trivial issue that they turned into something that was character defining, that was paradigm shifting, and they ran him off the stage.
And that stage he entered, by the way, on this record campaign of small donations assembled over the internet. That was the significant thing, and that was dismissed by the elites and the media with a scream.
It was incredible. And I think that the way things are going now, that the United States is going to have a rocky road ahead, because if the election were held tomorrow, it would appear that Hillary Rodham Clinton would prevail. But you're going to have a lot of disgruntled Donald J. Trump supporters who are not going away anytime soon. At the same time, I think that Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia and a close comrade of Hillary Rodham Clinton, probably hit the nail on the head when he suggested that after and if Clinton was elected, she would move to ratify the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. This, of course, is a third rail for many in the Sanders movement and for quite a few in the Trump movement, because I think that the working class generally recognizes that the question of trade is really only a proxy for another issue, that other issue being how the U.S. ruling elite moves factories and work to low-wage havens and then drives down working conditions and wages here in the United States of America. Sadly enough, the New York Times in that editorial a few days ago on the question of trade totally missed that fundamental point. And if Hillary Rodham Clinton is elected, which now seems likely, there's going to be a battle royal with regard to this question of trade, which of course bleeds into the question of foreign policy generally. And hopefully we can help to educate the white working class supporters of Trump to realize that their fate and destiny does not lie in a backward-looking alliance with billionaires, but lies, in fact, with class solidarity with their brothers and sisters here in North America. Now, I know, as of now, that sounds overly romantic, but quite frankly, if we are to save this planet, that's the only way out.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't know if it's romantic. It certainly looks formidable, but having met a lot of those folks, not as formidable as people may believe from following the media, because they were not as advertised, a group of maniacs with swastikas and stars and bars and all that. They were actually, a lot of them, working class people. So on the question of what McAuliffe said, you know, there's also the parallel, although the Obama administration's public stance on Russia was what it was up to 2014. The operation that took down the elected government in Kiev was conducted by, you know, both U.S. intelligence and the U.S. State Department. You had Pyatt and Nuland on the phone call. You could see what was being engineered there. Those really are Clinton's people, particularly Nuland, who goes back to Bill Clinton's administration. Does that mean, well, it seems to me that it means that similar to the predicted shift on a position on TPP back to the original, that we might be looking at a more aggressive and openly aggressive stand towards Russia with Clinton. What do you think of that?
Well, this is something that's in the works, I'm afraid. Today's Washington Post carries a story about how Clinton is treading a very careful line. On the one hand, she wants to win over these hawks and neocons, the few who have not defected to her column already. But at the same time, she's worried about riling up the Sandersistas, that is to say the peace forces within the Democratic Party. What that suggests to me is that if the result of the election is a landslide for Clinton, with left-wing parties not doing very well, you can take it to the bank that there's going to be a major military conflict in 2017. Most likely, there will be two flashpoints. One will be Syria, and the other will be Ukraine. I dare say that a Clinton-Kaine administration will see as a major priority rolling back the Russian intervention in Crimea. Also, I dare say that a Clinton-Kaine administration will seek to depose forever the al-Assad regime in Damascus in league with their allies in Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Now, of course, a fly in the ointment are the events of July 15th, 2016 in Turkey, with the failed coup and the concomitant escalation of anti-U.S. imperialist sentiment in Turkey, because Ankara has reason to believe that U.S. imperialism was, if not complicit, at least cheerleading on the coup makers, which has led to President Erdogan making his first trip abroad since July 15th to Moscow, leading to a relaxation of tensions with Moscow and Russia. The only problem there is that President Erdogan still continues to push this idea that a national priority for Ankara should be liquidating Kurdish resistance. And this is something that Moscow is not wholly on board with. In fact, this is something that a good deal of humanity is not on board with. And that makes Erdogan vulnerable because, of course, U.S. imperialism and Saudi reactionary clerics and leaders are not adverse to liquidating the Kurds or any other force that gets in the way of their messianic plots and plans. So this makes for a very dangerous recipe for 2017 as we contemplate the possibility of a Clinton administration surging to power without a vote in the millions for left-wing parties in the United States.
You know, also, I'd like to look at that geopolitically, too, because and in political context here of not only, you know, the new realignment, basically, apparent new realignment over some foreign policy issues among the party regulars, but also the introduction of this, you know, neo-McCarthyism that's actually a bit more extreme, given it lacks an ideological basis at this point, at least the strong ideological contradiction that existed in the late 40s and early 50s. Turkey making nice with Russia holds out the possibility, although it was said yesterday that this is not in the cards, of a realignment of Turkey's foreign policy away from NATO and towards Russia. Geopolitically, militarily, that's a very significant possibility if it comes to fruition. In other words, the placement or the use of Turkish airspace, for example, by the Russian Air Force based in Syria and or elsewhere adds a tremendous amount of movement to Russian defense against a NATO attack. Also, negating Turkey as a base for launching an attack would have significant consequences as well. So what do you think are the prospects for some kind of significant geopolitical shift that may be in the making now? And what do you think would be the consequences of that for the plans that seem to be to at least squeeze Russia?
Well, that is a very distinct possibility. That is to say, a Turkish realignment with Russia, which would obviously be a blow to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization led by the United States of America. I might also say that if you look at this in the European context, it's even more intriguing. What I mean is that the Brexit, the impending British withdrawal from the European Union, is also shaking up Europe because there are preliminary indications that British foreign policy will seek to reorient itself not only away from Europe, but perhaps as a spearhead against Europe. The only question is whether that spearhead against Europe will be in league with Washington, in which case that will inevitably cause what can only be described as a nightmare in Washington, which is that pushing Germany towards Russia. Recall that part of the import and impact of February 2014 and the Russian intervention in Crimea was allowing Washington the opportunity to pressure Germany to move away from a multi-billion-dollar relationship with Russia. including this relationship with Gazprom, the Russian natural gas producer, which helps to keep German homes warm and helps to keep the lights on throughout a good deal of Europe. With the Crimean intervention, Germany was pushed successfully away, at least for the short term, from Russia. But now, with the Brexit, you have these glimmerings of sentiment in the Foreign Office in London about Britain being sort of a free agent and also serving as sort of a beachhead against the European Union. Now, there's also a possibility that Britain will also sign up with Washington's messianic venture against China. There is a very important development taking place right now with regard to Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, pulling the plug on Hinkley Point, which was this joint Chinese-French venture to build a power plant in England. It was signed on personally by President Xi Jinping during his trip to London some months ago. It was seen as the inauguration of a new golden age in London-Beijing relations. But now, with Theresa May having second thoughts about that, that's calling into question that particular orientation of British foreign policy. It's helping to give rise to this idea that Britain will now double down on its relationship with Uncle Sam, not only as a possible beachhead against the EU, but also as a possible alliance against Beijing.
Yeah.
If that takes place, of course, this will have repercussions with regard to Russia, which already has deep and profound relations with China. Xi Jinping and Putin have met so many times that people are beginning to talk. So this is the state of play as we speak.
You know, and that, the you know, the publicizing of the second thoughts that May was having about this deal with Beijing, which also is, by the way, part of, I think, a package of five or six deals that China's now saying, if you don't want one, you don't get any of them, which, you know, is a further deterioration. But that came out within 24 hours of this leak, quote unquote, of this satellite evidence or aerial evidence that China, horror of horrors, is hiding planes on the Spratlys.
Well, yes. I mean, if conflict comes between the United States and China, a flashpoint will be these offshore islands that China claims, and of course, the Philippines also claims, in addition to other Southeast Asian nations. You may recall that just a few days ago, the World Court ruled that the Philippines have a valid claim in that part of the world. China has pledged to ignore the World Court decision, which is understandable because we all know that if we look at how the World Court has dealt with Africa and has not dealt with, say, war criminals like George W. Bush and Tony Blair, it becomes difficult to take the World Court seriously, not to mention its companion, the International Criminal Court.
Right.
So this ratcheting up of tensions with China is going to be a noticeable aspect of politics in 2017, whoever is elected president in the United States of America. And in that regard, I would point to A Straw in the Wind, which is a recent book by the Financial Times columnist Gideon Rachman entitled Easternization, as opposed to Westernization, of course, where he suggests, as many commentators have previously, that we are living through an epical millennial transition of power shifting from the North Atlantic to Asia, and more specifically, China. Now, we know that historically, such power shifts inevitably have been accompanied by conflict, sometimes murderous conflict. And this is something we have to be on guard against because we know that U.S. imperialism and their acolytes see it as their birthright to exert white supremacy, not only domestically, but globally. And the rise of a paramount China is, shall we say, inconsistent with the basic predicates of white supremacy, as we traditionally understand that phenomenon. So this, like a cold front meeting a warm front over the plains of Nebraska, inevitably can lead to a tornado-like effect that, if we are not careful, could spell doom for humanity.
There's an interesting contradiction, or maybe a set of contradictions, between Clinton and Trump with respect to China, particularly Trump saying on the one hand repeatedly throughout his campaign, do we really need to go to war with Russia and China? And he says, and China, all of the times. On the other hand, Clinton's policies, if they can be divined from what's happened in the past, have favored China in terms of economic relations, maybe more specifically American capital in China. And Trump is challenging that material aspect of the relationship, in rather strident terms. I wonder what that looks like from Beijing.
Well, as we try to figure out what ruling class policy is, particularly with regard to this bedrock issue of China, a couple of formulations come to mind. It seems as if one wing of the ruling class, and let us not forget that despite the defections of people who are considered to be hawks and neocons, Donald J. Trump still has a considerable amount of ruling class support. Carl Icahn, for example, the Manhattan billionaire, not to mention this board of economic advisors that he just announced that studded with various billionaires and miscreants of various types.
Right.
And that Trump faction of the U.S. ruling elite seems to be harking back once again to the pre-2014 Obama strategy, which is relaxing tensions with Moscow so as to be able to better confront China. Whereas the Clinton faction seems to want to not necessarily relax tensions with Russia, but to ratchet up tensions with Russia and perhaps take over, if I can put out that demented idea, take over or deeply influence Russia so as to have that as a platform through which to attack or undermine China. So I guess what we have is the Trump faction saying basically China first in terms of a point of attack, and the Clinton faction saying Russia first as a point of attack. Now, it seems to me both ideas are rather demented. However, it seems to me that if I'm a ruling class betar, and if I'm trying to put my chips on one of those horses, Russia is a country of 150 million. China is a country of 1.5 billion. China is a number two power rising with a bullet, pardon the expression. Mm-hmm. Whereas Russia is a powerful nuclear power, is not necessarily a powerful economic force, although the debility of the Russian economy has been overstated by people like Senator John McCain. And it's very interesting, you have this discourse on Russian weakness economically, yet they're able to hack into allegedly the CIA, the Democratic Party, Clinton's emails, etc. So, in any case, both strategies, it seems to me, have fundamental and structural weaknesses, and both strategies, ultimately, it seems to me, spell doom if carried out.
You know, there's something about the orientation of Germany towards Russia and the U.S. wishes for, to direct that against perhaps its natural flow. Going back to 1989, and earlier, with the reunification, there was apparently a struggle inside Germany between essentially industrial capital, productive capital, and finance capital, where as the industrialists saw the changing environment around them, we're looking at Russia like, wow, we're going to go make a lot of money developing Russia and all those resources, etc. And finance capital, apparently working in tandem with the United States, was like, no, we're going to loot it later. And that was the path that was followed. I'm wondering if Trump doesn't represent some sector of the productive or particularly construction capitalists in the United States, where they're sitting around with this huge untapped labor pool, all these huge needs for infrastructure development, housing, construction, all of that, watching finance capital make a fortune on Wall Street and everywhere they're playing, that capital not being available to them. And there's an antagonism, particularly between construction and finance capital, that you can see at the closing table when they close on the financing for their deals. But I'm wondering if maybe Trump doesn't represent some portion of the U.S. economic elite that wants to stop spending money on the military and to stop allowing finance capital to extract so much value from the economy and let them have some to go to work.
Well, it's clear that there are those in the U.S. ruling elite who would like to rein in finance capital. I mean, I think that that is understandable given the events of 2007-2008, the downturn on Wall Street, which obviously contributed mightily to the defeat of Senator John McCain in 2008, since he proved himself incapable of addressing that sticky wicket in particular. And it's also interesting to note this conflict between Berlin and Washington. It's not only the fact that Germany, a country of 82 million, has taken in about a million refugees who have been fleeing Syria in particular, but not Syria exclusively. And I should say parenthetically that this has not only been a so-called humanitarian gesture by Berlin. If you look very carefully, you'll notice that Germany has basically plundered the healthcare sector of Syria, with doctors and medics from Syria flooding into Germany. Not only that, but like many European countries, Germany has a demographic problem. That is to say, its population is growing older, and its population, which is increasingly migrating to the pension sector, needs a core of young workers, and those hundreds of thousands of refugees from Syria and other countries like Eritrea are now going to become that youthful sector of labor to keep the pensioners afloat. At the same time, you see that the United States has had difficulty in absorbing maybe 10,000, 15,000 Syrian refugees, with even progressive Vermont being the latest state to turn thumbs down on absorbing more Syrian refugees, Rutland, Vermont in particular. At the same time you have that conflict, you see how Volkswagen, this major German company, which it was caught with this hand in the cookie jar, that is to say that it was seen as fibbing with regard to the ability of its cars to pass pollution tests. But this has led to a mad scramble by not only the United States government, but also state governments to loot Volkswagen, driving down its share price simultaneously and calling into question the future of this foundational German company. Then there's Deutsche Bank, which is really on the ropes right now. I mean, it's incredible that that bank is still afloat. It's the major German bank, but yet it's hemorrhaging cash with every passing second.
A lot of it right here in the U.S., by the way, on bad mortgages.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a worldwide phenomenon. And then at the same time, you have this recent Financial Times article just yesterday about how Chinese companies are plowing into the manufacturing sector in Germany, buying up companies left and right, particularly companies of the future in the robotics sector. To the extent that that trend continues, it's going to be very difficult to keep Germany on side when it comes to Washington's anti-Moscow plans and anti-Beijing plans. And keep in mind that Germany was not necessarily on board with regard to the NATO intervention in Libya in 2011. And there is some consternation in Washington about the reliability of this so-called NATO ally. These are some of the complicating factors that whatever administration is incoming in January 2017 will have to grapple with.
And I wonder if we could shift focus. One of the things that is happening right now was the referral of the articles of impeachment for a trial of President Dilma Rousseff, suspended President Dilma Rousseff in Brazil. The vote was slightly higher on this referral than the original vote taken in the Brazilian Senate. And I'm wondering if that portends the outcome of the pending trial, which takes place in a context of having been initiated by someone who has since been driven from power over evidence of deep corruption.
Well, as of this moment, it does not look very good with regard to Dilma Rousseff and her Workers' Party administration in Brasilia. If we step back for a moment, it's really stunning the comeback that U.S. imperialism has made in the Americas. It's not only Dilma Rousseff being on the ropes, it's Mr. Maduro in Venezuela being on the ropes. It's the fact that the party of Kirchner lost in Argentina. And I think that this may not necessarily be some sort of mad coincidence. We'll have to await to a degree the opening of the archives of the Obama Presidential Library in Chicago, but it's not premature to suggest that as we look and reflect on, say, Ukraine and the downturn of relations with Russia in 2014, that the U.S. administration and U.S. imperialism generally responded hysterically to the rise of the BRICS and all of the reportage that was coming out, say, in 2009, 2010, about the BRICS and Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa becoming this new hegemon on the international scene. And now, as we survey the BRICS and we look at the fact that, as noted, Rousseff is on the ropes, the downturn of relations with Russia, the war talk, loose war talk about China. And then, of course, there are the South African elections, where the African National Congress, just a few days ago, suffered a setback, losing major control of major cities. Now, let me first of all say that I don't think you can understand that South African result without understanding that global context. But at the same time, I do think that there is a point to be made about the inadequacies of Jacob Zuma, the president, who in some ways is an embarrassment to the international movement. I mean, there was just a demonstration in South Africa a day or two ago as they were announcing the election results, where a number of young women held up signs with regard to the rape victim, the woman that Jacob Zuma was accused of raping a few years ago. He was put on trial. He was able to escape conviction because of a scurrilous counterattack against this rape victim. And to show you how Jacob Zuma personally has compromised the ANC, the African National Congress Women's League felt compelled to defend Jacob Zuma after he was charged with rape of a young woman under very questionable circumstances, to put it mildly. And then, of course, there's this corruption, his Nkandla estate on the Indian Ocean side of South Africa, where millions of dollars in government funds were used to refurbish this estate, which of course houses him and his, I've lost track of how many wives he has. It's four, five. I'm not really sure.
More than Johnny Carson.
So this has obviously compromised the ANC to a degree and has led directly to the result. I'm not sure if the ANC will move to dislodge him before presidential elections in 2019. But at the same time, I think it would be a mistake to just focus on Zuma as the sole culprit. Because even though this election has sent a signal to the ANC, it was not necessarily a progressive result. That is to say, the descendant of the old apartheid National Party, the Democratic Alliance, did very well. I don't see how the ANC is going to move aggressively towards redistribution when the old National Party descendant, the Democratic Alliance, is scoring in double digits and has at least black face leadership, if not, of course, not necessarily in terms of rank and file. And then there's the economic freedom fighters, led by Julius Malema, who once said, as an ANC cadre, that he would die, if not kill, for Jacob Zuma. This is when Jacob Zuma was in a conflict with his predecessor, Thabo Mbeki, the successor to Nelson Mandela as president, who, of course, was unseated in a kind of palace coup led by Jacob Zuma. Then, of course, Malema fell out with Zuma and started this other party, the EFF, the Economic Freedom Fighters. They did quite well in the elections, too. And they ran on this platform of radical redistribution, you know, which I'm sure many of your listeners will say right on.
Yes, indeed.
The problem is that the EFF has said that it would be very difficult for them to enter an alliance with the ANC in terms of ruling these key South African cities, and that they're, as of now, and this may change because it's a fluid situation, as of now, they're more prone to enter an alliance with the Democratic Alliance, which, of course, resists stoutly the idea of radical redistribution.
Right. Their constituency has all the wealth that they're talking about.
Right. So, I mean, this is obviously contradictory. So the South African citizenry, it seems to me, is going to have a very steep uphill climb going forward. And this is not even to mention the regional scenario. That is to say that we have many of our friends here in the United States, when you had an attempt at redistribution in Zimbabwe, and redistribution is not a very smooth and pretty process. There are going to be eggs cracked and dresses ruffled when you try to redistribute wealth and particularly land and property. And of course, that led to a clamoring against the government in Zimbabwe. That was actually one part of the bill of indictment against Thabo Mbeki. One of the reasons he was dislodged, it was said he was not aggressive enough in confronting the regime in Harare, Zimbabwe. And that led to the rise of Jacob Zuma. And I dare say that if there are moves towards radical redistribution of land and wealth in South Africa, that once again, eggs are going to be cracked, and some of our friends in the United States may be unsettled by that process, and I'm not sure where they'll end up, and that too will be complicating in terms of moving towards equity and true democracy, including economic democracy, in South Africa. So that's the situation as we speak.
And finally, we have like 3 minutes. Looking in South Africa, you also have the great game, quote unquote, that's going on between the U.S. and EU on one side, China on the other, and the alignment of political forces on the ground in relation to that. You want to talk to that?
Well, there's a lot of hysteria in the United States right now about the Chinese role in Africa. Your fellow New Yorker, Howard French, who teaches at Columbia University Journalism School and was a former New York Times correspondent in both Africa and China, has just written a recent book which sounds the alarm about alleged Chinese encroachments in Africa. It seems to me what this bespeaks is a kind of hysteria about the decline of U.S. imperialism. and the fact that Africa historically has been a preserve not only for U.S. imperialism, but North Atlantic imperialism. And if it seems as if the North Atlantic countries are leaving or losing their preserve, their foothold in Africa, this bespeaks a overall decline, particularly vis-a-vis China. And that's the message I took from Howard French's book. But there's another complicating factor as well, and that is that perhaps the closest ally on the African continent of Beijing is Zimbabwe. That relationship goes back to the 1960s, if not before, and to the beginnings of the Liberation War, ignited with the illegal unilateral declaration of independence by the racist minority regime, November 11, 1965. And what makes this more intriguing is that it has Cold War connotations, because what happened was that in terms of the standoff between Moscow and Beijing that characterized that period, the prevailing party in Zimbabwe, the ZANU-PF under President Robert Mugabe, was one of the few liberation movements that was four square in the corner of Beijing, as opposed to the ANC, which was much closer to Moscow. Although it's fair to say that the ANC did try to maintain positive relations with Beijing, but that was not always possible. That also had repercussions in terms of the conflict in Zimbabwe after land reform, because China was standing very closely to Harare, as noted, and I had warned the South African comrades that if they followed the advice of some of our left-wing friends in the United States, not to mention U.S. imperialism and British imperialism, and tried to confront Zimbabwe over land reform, that this could boomerang, given China's rising profile in the international community and China's ability to mobilize with Zimbabwe against the South African regime. Fortunately, Jacob Zuma rejected the advice of British imperialism and of some of our left-wing friends, and contrary to what was thought, did not reverse Mbeki's policy towards Zimbabwe after he came into office. But this whole question of China's role in Africa is still hanging fire. And I should also say that this is also hanging fire with regard to what's going on in Ethiopia. I'm sure you're following the tragedy that's unfolded in the streets of Addis Ababa in recent days, with scores allegedly being massacred by the ruling party, which of course has 100% of the seats in parliament, but is sitting on a power keg because the way that many in Ethiopia view that particular regime is of being a minority Tigrayan clique ruling over a majority Oromo and Amhara population. China comes into play because what's happening globally right now is that a lot of production is moving across the Indian Ocean from China into East Africa, particularly Ethiopia, which has a population of about 100 million. It's estimated that by the end of the century, Ethiopia will be one of the 10 most populous nations on planet Earth, assuming that climate change or other catastrophes does not overcome us all. And so what's going on in Ethiopia, once again, is a signal, because the U.S. administration also has been quite close to the regime in Addis Ababa. But with this unrest in the streets, and it's no telling where this unrest will lead, it's probably fair to say that U.S. imperialism is reassessing, and to come full circle, just like they were reassessing on July 15th, 2016, when it seemed that there was going to be a coup in Turkey.
Dr. Horn, thank you very much. We'll have to leave it there. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for inviting me. Hang on.